In the palace of Moctezuma, the emperor's angry words echoed down the halls. He had summoned his chief soothsayers and magicians, and was taking out all his frustration on them. Part of their job was to predict the future by all the known means, by taking hallucinogenic mushrooms and gazing into obsidian mirrors, by casting kernels of grain onto the pages of holy books, and tying and untying knots. But now they had all failed to predict the astonishing arrival of these bizarre foreigners. The priest Diego Duran later wrote down recollections of those who were there. Moctezuma, furious, cried, "It is your position, then, to be deceivers, tricksters, to pretend to be men of science and forecast that which will take place in the future, deceiving everyone by saying that you know what will happen in the world, that you see what is within the hills, in the center of the earth. But everything is a lie. It is all pretense." When his rage abated, Moctezuma must have pored over the images that his painters brought back to him. The ships with white sails, the men in their iron clothes, and perhaps most strangely, the creatures they rode on. Apparently a kind of tall deer with no horns. He must have blanched as the ambassadors described the demonstration of the foreigners' weapons. Especially did it cause him to faint when he heard how the gun, at command, discharged, how it resounded as if it had thundered when it went off. Fire went showering forth, sparks went blazing forth, and its smoke smelled very foul. And when the shot struck a mountain, it was as if it were destroyed, dissolved. And a tree was pulverized. It was as if it vanished. It was as if someone blew it away. Moctezuma is often caricatured as a weak and indecisive emperor, hamstrung by superstition. But that's not entirely fair. Later European writers delighted in sharing stories of how the Aztecs believed them to be some kind of god, perhaps even Quetzalcoatl himself. But none of this is held up by evidence. If the Mexica ever mistook the Spanish for gods, it's clear they quickly assessed the reality of the situation. That these were men from a different place, whose weapons were more powerful than their own. In those first days, Moctezuma actually took a number of decisive measures. First, he sent out messengers to all the cities of Mexico to find out what was known about these strangers. Next, he ordered spies to every town and village between Tenochtitlan and the coast to report back immediately if the Spanish tried to move inland. He created a war room in Tenochtitlan where people could constantly update him on the Spaniards' movements, and even commanded his magicians to place hexes on the foreigners. But despite these measures, the uncertainty began to take its toll. Moctezuma enjoyed no sleep, no food. No one spoke more to him. Whatsoever he did, it was as if he were in torment. Oft times it was as if he sighed, became weak, felt weak. No longer did he enjoy what tasted good, what gave one contentment. The Spaniards' advantage wasn't simply in guns, steel, and horses, but also in information. To Moctezuma, they were a complete mystery. He didn't know what they wanted. They didn't have a city that could be besieged, or wives and children that could be captured for leverage. They had no known weaknesses, making it very difficult to devise a strategy against them. But on the Spanish side, things were rather different. The comparatively quick and widespread communication channels available to the Spanish gave them a geopolitical perspective throughout the events that the Aztecs, for all their intelligence, even brilliance, simply lacked, writes historian Camilla Townsend. In the days after landing in Mexico, Cortes had already sent letters to Spain, requesting reinforcements and providing information about the new lands. His letters were soon printed and distributed around European cities, inspiring others to follow in his footsteps. Cortes also benefited from years of experience of similar conquests in the Caribbean, where all the elements of his strategy had already been extensively tested. The finding of interpreters, the gathering of information, the taking of hostages, and the recruitment of native allies. In fact, in only a few days, Cortes had learned all the information he needed. He knew that Moctezuma was the most powerful emperor in the region, who ruled from a city called Tenochtitlan, and possessed a great deal of gold. Even more important, he learned that this Moctezuma had enemies. The key to his strategy would be to find allies among the people who hated the Aztecs the most. These, he soon learned, were the besieged and terrorized people of Tlaxcala. On the 8th of August, 1519, Cortes set out towards Tenochtitlan, with the intention of passing through the Tlaxcala Valley and making contact with these great enemies of the Mexica. He knew that the road to the coast would be his lifeline for supplies and reinforcements, and so he left almost half of his company in Veracruz, taking with him 300 foot soldiers and 15 horsemen. The Valley of Mexico lay about 400 kilometers from the coast. The first stretch of the journey was flat, hot, and tropical, with dense forests dotted with Aztec plantations of maize and other crops. Then the great snow-capped volcanoes rose up ahead of them. Everywhere they went, villages gave them supplies of maize and gold, even additional local slaves whom they used to haul their guns. They crossed a cold, bleak salt flat where water became scarce, and they soon ran out of food. "God knows how much my people suffered from thirst and hunger," wrote Cortes, "and especially from a hail and rainstorm that hit us there." Bernal Diaz remembers, "There was a great scarcity of food, and a wind came down from the snowy hills on one side of us, which made us shiver. But eventually, they managed to reach the Tlaxcala lands." Cortes expected to be welcomed with open arms, but years of conflict had clearly put the Tlaxcalans on the defensive. Their country had often been entered by craft and cunning and then laid waste, and they thought that this was another attempt to do so, Bernal Diaz writes. "As we marched on, two armies of warriors approached to give us battle. They numbered 6,000 men, and they came on us with loud shouts and the din of drums and trumpets as they shot their arrows and hurled their darts." For the next 2 days, the Tlaxcalans clashed with the Spanish, sending ever greater numbers of troops to meet them, until, according to Cortes, 150,000 soldiers were ranged against them, presumably the entire army of the Tlaxcalans. All the while, Cortes tried to make signs of peace and begged them, through interpreters, to stop their attack. The Tlaxcalans fell on the Spanish lines and nearly surrounded them, but the glass blades of their macuahuitl shattered against the steel armor of the Europeans. The Spanish steel swords sliced their cotton armor, while crossbow bolts and gunshots tore through their ranks and spread terror. The Spanish horsemen repeatedly charged with their lances. In this engagement, one soldier was killed and 60 were wounded, Bernal Diaz writes, and all the horses were wounded as well. The Tlaxcalans eventually grew dispirited and withdrew. Cortes and his men descended on nearby Tlaxcalan villages, slaughtering everyone they could find. I burnt more than 10 villages, in one of which there were more than 3,000 houses, Cortes wrote. The inhabitants fought with us, although there was no one there to help them. With the devastation of their lands threatened, the Tlaxcalans relented and sued for peace. The following day, messengers arrived from the chieftains, Cortes wrote back to the Spanish king, saying that they wished to be vassals of your highness and my friends, and they begged me to forgive them for what they had done. Cortes now had the allies he needed. The defeat of the Tlaxcalan army by little more than 300 foreign soldiers sent ripples through the Aztec world, as Bernal Diaz recalls. Terror fell on the whole country at learning how, being so few in number and the Tlaxcalans in such great force, we had conquered them. So that now Montezuma, the great prince of Mexico, powerful as he was in fear of our going to his city, and sent 5 chieftains, men of much importance, to our camp at Tlaxcala to bid us welcome, and say that he was rejoiced at our great victory against so many squadrons of warriors. Moctezuma's messengers told Cortes that the Aztec emperor would be delighted to welcome him to Tenochtitlan. However, it was better if he didn't come. The roads were bad, unfortunately, and supplies of food in Tenochtitlan had been very low recently. They were only thinking of the Spanish and their comfort, they said. Cortes lied, insisting his king had ordered him to go to Tenochtitlan. The Mexica warned him also never to trust the Tlaxcalans, for it was in their nature to be traitors. When I saw the discord and animosity between these two peoples, I was not a little pleased, Cortes wrote, for it seemed to further my purpose considerably, and I remember that one of the Gospels says, Omne regnum in se ipsum divisum, de sol abitur. A kingdom divided cannot stand. Cortes's expedition stayed in the capital of Tlaxcala for a few weeks, and he ordered his men to be on their best behavior, not to take anything that wasn't offered to them or enter the temple district of the city. Its citizens soon warmed to the Spanish, even showing them some of their precious relics, giant bones, presumably of mammoths. They said that in times past there had lived among them men and women of giant size with huge bones. So that we could see how huge and tall these people had been, they brought us a leg bone of one of them, which was very thick and the height of a man, Bernal Diaz writes. It's clear that the Tlaxcalans began to see a rare opportunity in these strange guests to change their fortunes for the better. They told Cortes that the nearby city of Cholula was a great ally of Moctezuma and that attacking it would significantly weaken him. In reality, the Cholulans weren't particularly close to the Mexica, but they were a powerful rival of the Tlaxcalans. Alarmed at the thought of the nearby threat and urged on by the Tlaxcalans, Cortes marched to Cholula alongside a large army of Tlaxcalan warriors. It was a wealthy city with many tall towers, and it once held the world's largest pyramid by volume. When the Spanish and their allies arrived, the Cholulans met them peacefully, but Cortes unleashed a tidal wave of violence. The Florentine Codex records the stabbing, the slaying, the beating of the people. The Cholulan had suspected nothing. Neither with arrows nor with shields had he contended against the Spaniards. The massacre went on for 2 days. The whole city burned, and the Spaniards destroyed a temple to the god Quetzalcoatl, the primary god of Cholula. This was a clear message to Moctezuma. The city of Tenochtitlan now lay only 80 kilometers away, beyond a wall of soaring volcanoes. Cortes's ultimate destination was drawing near. When Moctezuma heard of the sacking of the powerful city of Cholula and the destruction of the temple by only a couple of hundred Spaniards, he was inconsolable, as the Florentine Codex recalls. All of which had come to pass, they gave, told, related all the account to Moctezuma. It was as if the earth moved, just as if the earth rebelled, just as if all revolved before one's eyes. There was terror. Moctezuma had a spy in every village, and with each report that came in, he knew the Spaniards were drawing closer, along with thousands of Tlaxcalan warriors and other peoples who had joined their ranks. In a desperate attempt, Moctezuma even sent one of his servants, dressed in royal garbs, with as much gold as he could carry, hoping that if he gave them what they wanted, gold and a meeting with him, they would turn back. But the Spaniards saw through the disguise. Next, he ordered the roads to be blocked with cactuses and other thorned plants like agave, but the Spaniards easily overcame these obstacles, and panic descended in Moctezuma's court. The magicians that Moctezuma had sent to slow down the foreigners reported that their spells had had no effect. Even worse, some of them had experienced visions in which they saw the whole Aztec Empire, all its temples and palaces, houses and towers, going up in flames. Finally, Cortes and his men passed through the mountains and saw the Valley of Mexico stretching out before them. They would have seen the wide blue waters of Lake Texcoco, the white clutter of dozens of cities ringing its bank, the grasslands striated with fields of corn, beans, chili peppers and cotton, smoke rising from the chimneys. And in the middle of the lake, the glittering jewel of Tenochtitlan. Many of the conquistadors were speechless. Others, like Francisco de Aguilar, would later gush about what they saw. Castellated fortresses, splendid monuments, royal dwelling places, glorious heights. How marvelous it was to gaze on them. As they approached the causeway, out in the middle of the bridge, the Spanish saw a figure standing in a crown of green quetzal feathers, surrounded on either side by warriors wearing jaguar skins and eagle feathers. Emperor Moctezuma had come out to meet them. Tenochtitlan was guarded by the vast army of the Aztec Empire. It's quite possible at this point that they could have overwhelmed the Spanish, as the Tlaxcalans nearly had. But Moctezuma knew that if he tried and failed to defeat them in full view of his citizens, his kingship and likely his life would be over. So he had decided to finally meet this foreigner and see what he wanted. The Florentine Codex recounts the sight the Spaniards made. Their iron lances, their halberds seemed to glisten, and their iron swords were wavy like a watercourse. Some came all in iron, they came turned into iron, they came gleaming. Hence they were dreaded. Neither Cortes nor Moctezuma were much given to flowery words. According to the Florentine Codex, the following exchange is all they said at first. Then Cortes said to Moctezuma, "Is this not thou? Art thou not he? Art thou Moctezuma?" Moctezuma replied, "Indeed, yes, I am he." Thereupon he arose. He arose to meet him face to face. Moctezuma extended his courtesy to the Spaniards, and they were shown into the city and given lodgings in a former royal apartment while he worked out what they wanted. The palace, wrote Francisco de Aguilar, was a wonder to behold. There were innumerable rooms inside, antechambers, splendid halls, mattresses of large cloaks, pillows of leather and tree fiber, good eiderdowns, and admirable white fur robes. When the Spanish arrived in their opulent lodgings, they began firing off their guns and cannons in celebration. The sounds resounded around the city streets, and the locals hid in fear. Fear prevailed. It was as if everyone had swallowed his heart. Even before it had grown dark, there was terror. There was astonishment. There was apprehension. There was a stunning of the people. As Cortes and his men went to sleep that night in the palace, they would have heard the soft blowing of conch shells echoing from the temples at midnight. The beating of drums would have announced the arrival of the dawn. Cortes and his men spent the next few days in the city of Tenochtitlan. They saw the towering blood-stained temples and the market of Tlatelolco. Some of the soldiers among us who had been in many parts of the world, Bernal Diaz wrote, in Constantinople and all over Italy, and in Rome, said that so large a marketplace and so full of people and so well regulated and arranged, they had never beheld before. Moctezuma, increasingly feeling that he was losing control of his kingdom, gave up much of his treasury to the Spaniards. He handed over ornately decorated gold jewelry, headbands and chest plates, statues and other incomparable works of art, most of which they immediately melted down into gold bricks. But none of this seemed to satisfy them. It seemed as if they were waiting for something, and Moctezuma would soon find out what that was. Not long after Cortes's arrival in Tenochtitlan, news arrived from Veracruz that six of Cortes's men had been killed in a quarrel with some local Mexica. This was a relatively minor trifle, but Cortes welcomed it as a pretext to move against Moctezuma and take the Aztec emperor himself as a hostage. He swept into the throne room and told Moctezuma to go with the Spanish to their lodgings, for his own protection. Cortes warned the emperor not to make a noise or cry out in any way, telling him, "Order your people not to be angry or make a disturbance, and bear in mind that if any ill befalls us, you will pay for it with your life." The emperor realized what was happening, and he must have gone pale. He pleaded with the Spaniards to reconsider. "My person is not such as can be made a prisoner of," he told them. "Even if I would like it, my people would not suffer it." But suffer it they did. That night, Cortes arrested 17 Mexica lords who he said had plotted the attacks. He had them burned alive in the courtyard of the great temple, using piles of arrows and wooden macuahuitl from the Tenochtitlan armory as kindling. Moctezuma was brought to watch with chains on his feet. If before this he was scared, Bernal Diaz recounts, he was then much more so. It said the Mexica watched the executions in complete silence. It would have been clear to everyone, even the common people in the street, that from this moment on, Cortes was the true power in the Aztec Empire. Moctezuma, for the most part, bore his imprisonment with dignity but resignation. He continued the usual business of governing his empire. He met his lords and watched jugglers and poets as usual, but everywhere he went, Spanish guards went with him. He must have felt a sense of abject misery and fear. But then in April 1520, a messenger managed to slip the Aztec emperor a secret note that represented a glimmer of hope. It was a painting of 19 Spanish ships off the coast of Mexico. To Moctezuma, the meaning was clear. Another group of Spaniards were arriving, and they were not friends of Cortés. Diego de Velázquez, the governor of Cuba, had spent the 6 months since Cortés's departure stewing in his bitterness. He had confiscated much of Cortés's property in Cuba, but this had done little to sate his appetite for revenge. When he heard that Cortés had sent news and chests full of gold directly to the king, bypassing him completely, Velázquez exploded. He ordered one of his lieutenants, named Pánfilo de Narváez, to sail to Mexico with 900 men, apprehend Cortés, and drag him back to Cuba in chains. With the use of couriers and secret notes, Moctezuma was able to communicate with Narváez as he sailed up the Mexican coast. Narváez told Moctezuma that Cortés and his men did not, in fact, have the support of the Spanish crown. Narváez sent to tell Moctezuma many abusive and many uncivil things about Cortés and all of us, remembers Bernal Díaz, such that we were bad men and thieves who had fled from Castile without the permission of our lord and king. Moctezuma sent Narváez food and gold and begged him to come and help. But all the while, he played the model prisoner. He and Cortés even played a Mexica game of marbles called Totoloque, although Moctezuma politely complained that the Spaniard cheated when he kept score, in that he always marked 1 point too many. But as time went on, Moctezuma grew terrified that his double dealings would be discovered. He went to Cortés and came clean, hoping that the news would spur the Spaniards to pack up and flee. He urged him to leave Tenochtitlan while there was still time. Cortés was in a bind. "I dared not leave the city," he wrote, "for fear that once I had done so, the inhabitants would rebel, and I would lose all the gold, the jewels, and even the city itself. For once that was lost, the whole country would be lost also." He would now have to march back to the coast and face Narváez, leaving enough of his men behind to hold the emperor prisoner. His force would be dangerously split, and everything he had won now lay in the balance. At the start of May, Cortés and as many as 250 of his men set off on their march back to the coast. Cortés sent a messenger to the Tlaxcalans, asking them for 4,000 men to help him fight Narváez. But this development had clearly shaken their confidence in their new ally. They sent Cortés 20 turkeys as a gift instead. On the coast, Narváez had landed and set up camp at a place called Kempoala, at the top of one of the town's temples, and waited for Cortés's army to arrive. Narváez outnumbered Cortés 3-1 and was confident of success. But Cortés had been in Mexico for over a year at that point and had learned how best to fight in the landscape. While Narváez slept, Cortés and his men crept through the night, a torrential rain covering their movements. They climbed the pyramid stealthily and ambushed the guards, setting the temple on fire as they went. In the skirmish that followed, Narváez lost his right eye and surrendered. His soldiers were mercenaries with no particular loyalty, and when Cortés dazzled them with stories of mountains of gold waiting back in Tenochtitlan, they agreed to join him. Far from defeating Cortes, Velazquez had delivered him fresh reinforcements. More powerful than ever, he now set his sights on returning to Tenochtitlan. But in his absence, events in the city had taken a dark turn. The man that Cortes had left in charge was named Pedro de Alvarado. Alvarado was a harsh man with a red beard, flamboyant and quick to anger. Perhaps the worst person to command such a precarious situation. Cortes had left him only about 100 men and a crowd of Tlaxcala allies of doubtful loyalty. And with these, he had to keep his grasp on a city of perhaps 200,000. The situation would come to a head as an annual Mexica ceremony neared, an event known as the Festival of Toshcatl. The Toshcatl ceremony involved the sacrifice of a young man, chosen from among the people for his good looks and charm. For the last year, he had lived as an embodiment of the god Tezcatlipoca, being showered with every luxury. But now his time had come, and he would be sacrificed. Before he left, Cortes had given Moctezuma permission to hold the festival, on condition that there would be no human sacrifice that year. But with Cortes gone, the Mexica sensed weakness and division in the foreigners. They stopped providing the Spaniards with food, and some collaborating Mexica turned up dead. Alvarado feared that the Mexica were preparing to scale the palace walls or tunnel under them to rescue the captive Moctezuma. The Spaniards began to feel increasingly under siege. On the third night of the festival, the Mexica sang sacred songs and dressed in feathered headdresses and bright embroidered clothes. There was singing, the Florentine Codex recalls. The singing resounded like waves breaking. As the ceremony went on, it became obvious that the Mexica were going to ignore Cortes's orders and carry out the sacrifice anyway. Alvarado, enraged at their disobedience, ordered his men into the sacred precinct, dressed for war. Other armored soldiers guarded the exits. As the festival reached its climax and the drums crashed and flutes shrieked, Alvarado commanded the Spanish to fall upon the gathered Mexica, and a slaughter began. The Mexica memories of this event, recorded in the Florentine Codex, are full of gruesome, specific details that read like the authentic memories of trauma. Thereupon they surrounded the dancers. Thereupon they went among the drums. Then they struck the drummer's arms. They severed both his hands. Then they struck his neck. Far off did his neck and head go to fall. Of some they slashed open their backs, then their entrails gushed out. Of some they cut their heads to pieces. They absolutely pulverized their heads. And when in vain one would run, he would only drag his intestines like something raw as he tried to escape. The Spaniards began to loot and burn the temples in a frenzy of destruction, and the Mexica realized that this was their chance to regain their freedom. The drums beat, and an Aztec priest is said to have bellowed out, "Brave warriors, O Mexicans, hasten here. Already they have died, they have perished, they have been annihilated. O Mexicans, O brave warriors." Commoners grabbed their weapons, and warriors flooded the street. The Spanish were forced to retreat to the palace, where they settled in for a siege, with a number of their Tlaxcalan allies and the emperor as their hostage, waiting for Cortes to return. After 23 days, Cortes returned to the shores of Lake Texcoco. His forces swelled by Narvaez's men. He now commanded about 1,000 Spaniards and many thousands of reassured Tlaxcalan warriors who had joined him on his return journey. Cortes found Alvarado and his men holed up in the palace on the edge of starvation. The city was in open revolt, and the crowds came out every day to batter on the palace doors. Cortes ordered Moctezuma to go out onto the terrace of the palace and appeal for calm. 17 years earlier, a similar crowd had cheered his glorious coronation, but now the Mexica met their emperor with utter silence. Moctezuma called out that it would be better to surrender to the Spanish, that it was impossible to fight them. One source, the Codex Ramirez, recalls an Aztec warrior shouting back to Moctezuma, "What is that which is being said by that scoundrel of a Montezuma, whore of the Spaniards? Does he think that he can call to us with his woman-like soul to fight for the empire which he has abandoned out of fright?" It wasn't long before the first stones began to rain down on the king, and as soon as the first one landed, his authority vanished. Soon the whole crowd was pelting him. Moctezuma was struck several times before the Spanish were able to rescue him. It said he refused any treatment for his wounds and died on the morning of the 30th of June, 1520. Some Mexica sources refute the claim that Moctezuma was killed in this way and say that the Spanish simply knifed him once their situation in the city became untenable. Either way, they were quick to burn the body, as the Florentine Codex records. Thereupon they placed him on a pile of wood. Thereupon they kindled it, they set fire to it. Thereupon the fire crackled, seeming to flare up, to send up many tongues of flame, and Moctezuma's body seemed to lie sizzling, and it smelled foul as it burned. Cortes knew that he could not stay in the city. His power over the Mexica people had evaporated. He hatched a plan to slip out of the palace and across the western causeway while the Mexica slept. His men packed all the gold they could carry into their bags and muffled the hooves of their horses. "It was somewhat dark and cloudy and rainy," remembers Bernal Diaz. "Everything went to plan at first. But as they crept through the narrow streets, a woman by the docks spotted them and shouted out a warning. And soon, the voices, trumpets, cries, and whistles of the Mexicans began to sound. On open ground, the Spanish horses and cannons were unbeatable. But in the narrow streets, on the islands broken by bridges and canals, the Aztecs knew exactly how to fight. They massed around the Spanish in war canoes and on the rooftops, pelting them with arrows and stones, while warriors ran them down from the rear. "Two of the horses slipped and fell into the lake," writes Bernal Diaz. "The lake was full of canoes so that we could do nothing." The Mexica's hatred was now such that they abandoned their usual battle practice of taking captives, instead killing the Spaniards with a sharp blow to the back of the head, a punishment usually reserved for petty criminals. The bodies of the dead on both sides choked up the canals, and legend has it that some of the Spanish, weighted down with stolen gold, sank to the bottom of the lake. The retreat became a rout. A reasonable estimate for the number of Spanish killed on this night is around 600. Thousands of their Tlaxcalan allies were killed too. But just over 400 Spaniards, Cortes among them, managed to fight their way across the causeway to safety. They managed to fight off the pursuing Aztec forces at the Battle of Otumba, where once again their horsemen were in their element on the open ground. From there, they fled back to the safety of Tlaxcala. Tenochtitlan had delivered the most crushing defeat ever inflicted on European colonists in the New World. The Spanish would call it the Noche Triste, the Night of Sorrows. The Mexica must have been elated, but their emperor now lay dead, and multiple tributary cities were openly denying the authority of Tenochtitlan. The fabric of the Aztec Empire was fraying. Cortes was by this point a man possessed. Many of his men begged him to march back to the coast, where they could fortify Veracruz and prepare for a counterattack. But he refused. "On no account would I go across the mountains to the coast," he wrote. "I told them that I would not abandon this land." At Tlaxcala, he spent the next 6 months gathering an army of tens of thousands of native allies to add to his remaining Spaniards. And at the head of this army, he marched to Tenochtitlan just after Christmas of 1520. When the Spaniards reached the lake, they now marched at the head of an army of as many as 200,000 native allies who had all come to take part in the final destruction of Tenochtitlan. At the lakeshore, they cut down pine trees to build 12 ships of a kind known as brigantines, which they loaded with cannons and musketeers. Cortes first blocked all the main causeways leading to Tenochtitlan, and with his ships, blockaded any attempts to resupply it by water. Tenochtitlan was now truly under siege. The Mexica were not only besieged and encircled from without, they were now also coming under attack from an invisible enemy. When the expedition of Pánfilo de Narváez had arrived in Mexico to arrest Cortés, he had brought with him some enslaved African men. And one of these, named Francisco de Eguía, was apparently infected with smallpox. When they had stayed the night in Cempoala, he had spread this disease to an indigenous family before dying, and from there, the fates of millions in the New World were sealed. "There spread over the people a great destruction of men," the Florentine Codex records. "Some it indeed covered with pustules. They were spread everywhere, on one's face, on one's head, on one's breast, and so on. There was indeed perishing. Many indeed died of it." Bernal Diaz writes that the whole country was stricken and filled with it, from which there was great mortality, for according to what the Indians said, they had never had such a disease. In the Old World, after millennia of exposure to smallpox, the disease still killed a third of all the people it infected, usually in childhood. But in the New World, it combined with other diseases like measles to tear through populations, in places killing 9 out of every 10 people. This critically weakened the Aztecs and harrowed their leadership. Moctezuma's successor, a man named Cuitlahuac, even died of smallpox during the siege. After many weeks, Cortes finally advanced into the starved city across its 3 causeways. The fighting was bitter, going street to street, fighting for each house and bridge at a time, with heavy losses. The Mexica began to use sacrifices as a weapon of terror, in full view of the Spanish armies. "On some high towers which are there, they sacrificed them naked," Cortes remembers, "opening their chests and tearing out their hearts as an offering to the idols. The Spaniards recognized those who were being sacrificed as Christians by their white, naked bodies." At night, the Mexica beat their war drums incessantly, so that Bernal Diaz grew to hate the cursed drum, which I again declare had the most accursed sound and the most dismal that it was possible to invent. The resilience of the Aztecs took Cortes by surprise, and he soon resorted to extreme methods. He had wanted to hand the city of Tenochtitlan over to his king as a pristine prize, but now he ordered the Spanish to demolish every district they came to and use the rubble to fill in the canals and waterways. Just as the Spanish adapted their tactics, the Mexica learned to make evasive maneuvers in their canoes to escape from gunfire, and even lured some of Cortes's brigantines onto submerged sandbanks, then boarding and killing their commanders. At night, the city's defenders snuck out and cleared the rubble from the canals. But as the months of grinding battle wore on, famine and disease weakened the Mexica. They ate wood and leather, even bricks crushed into powder. When the Spanish reached the city center, they located the well that the Mexica had been drinking from and destroyed it, forcing them to drink the salty lake water instead. The Aztecs had no new supplies, no new soldiers, and no relief. Meanwhile, a steady flow of supplies came from the coast to Cortes. The result of the battle must have become clear. The final stand took place in the great market of Tlatelolco, where the Mexica were surrounded and utterly destroyed. They finally surrendered on the 13th of August, 1521. Some years later, an Aztec poet wrote the following bitter lament about the fall of the city. Broken spears lie in the roads. We have torn our hair in our grief. The houses are roofless now, and their walls are red with blood. Worms are swarming in the streets and plazas, and the walls are spattered with gore. The water has turned red as if it were dyed, and when we drink of it, it has the taste of brine. We have pounded our hands in despair against the adobe walls. For our inheritance, our city is lost and dead. The shields of our warriors were its defense, but they could not save it. The Spaniards stood victorious over the smoking ruins of Tenochtitlan. Hernán Cortés and his small group of soldiers had, within 2 years, brought down an empire. But not everyone was satisfied with their takings. All of us captains and soldiers were somewhat thoughtful, remembers Bernal Díaz, when we saw how little gold there was and how poor and unjust were our shares. The victory had come at great cost. Humiliated by his failure to capture the city intact, Cortes soon set about erasing all trace of Tenochtitlan. He enslaved vast numbers of Mexica and put them to work demolishing their own city, all its houses and palaces and temples, and building European-style buildings on the ruins. He even changed Tenochtitlan's name, renaming it Mexico, because it was an easier word for the Spanish to pronounce. The Franciscan friar, Toribio de Benavente Motolinía, who arrived there 4 years later, described the hellish scenes. The seventh plague was the construction of the great city of Mexico, which during the early years used more people than in the construction of Jerusalem. The crowds of laborers were so numerous that one could hardly move in the streets and causeways, although they are very wide. Many died from being crushed by beams or falling from high places, or in tearing down old buildings for new ones. After the empire collapsed, the Spanish did their best to eradicate Aztec culture, burning all the Mexica books they could find, so that today only 16 books written by pre-contact Aztecs have survived. During the siege, the Spanish had destroyed the Aztec dams and methods for water control. And so in its early years, Mexico City was prone to destructive floods. To remedy this, in the 1600s, the great Lake Texcoco was drained, in the hope that fertile farmlands would be revealed beneath the water. But all that took its place were stagnant salt flats. Across these, the new Mexico City would expand at an enormous rate. Today, it is one of the largest cities in North America, with more than 20 million people living in its wider metropolitan area. The entire lake bed was paved over, and the enormous expanse of Lake Texcoco simply ceased to exist. Today, Mexico City is still beset with floods and subsidence caused by the ghost of this vanished lake. Diego Velázquez, the governor of Cuba and Cortés's nemesis, was dismissed as governor in 1521 when his abuse of indigenous labor became too embarrassing for the crown. But he was restored to office 2 years later. He died unexpectedly 1 year after that, at the age of 59, and on his death was considered the richest Spaniard in the Americas. Pánfilo de Narváez, the captain who had been sent to arrest Cortés, was released from captivity after 2 years and sent back to Spain, missing one eye. He returned to adventuring in the Americas several years later in 1527 and led a disastrous expedition to Florida. Hurricanes, shipwrecks, and disease meant that of the 600 men he set sail with, only 4 made it home. Narváez himself was drowned. Malintzin, the enslaved woman that had accompanied Cortés on his conquest and acted as his translator, would go on to give birth to Cortés's son. She later married one of his soldiers, who she followed to Spain. She was warmly received there at the Spanish court and became a Spanish lady of high society. The story of Cortés's destruction of the Aztec Empire would become legendary in Europe, and the publication of his letters in the years that followed caused a sensation. The myth of the handful of conquistadors toppling an empire began to be exaggerated, and the contribution of hundreds of thousands of Tlaxcalan warriors forgotten. The kingdoms and lines of the Assyrians, Medes, and Persians ended, but their names and renown live on in the histories, gushes de Gomera. The conquest of Mexico and the conversion of the peoples of New Spain can and should be included in the histories of the world. Long live, then, the name and memory of him who conquered so vast a land. Cortés would spend the rest of his life chasing after the feeling of glory that he must have felt at the fall of Tenochtitlan, but he would never recapture it. He returned to Spain several times, but his fame and popularity threatened the Castilian nobility, and he was sidelined at court. On one possibly apocryphal occasion, he even tried to talk to the Spanish king by jumping aboard his carriage. The king didn't even recognize him and asked who he thought he was. Cortés is supposed to have replied indignantly, "I am Hernán Cortés, who has given you more kingdoms than all the towns bequeathed to you by your ancestors." Cortés died of dysentery in Seville on the 2nd of December, 1547. He was 62 years old, embittered and alone. Perhaps fittingly for such a restless, dissatisfied character, his remains were moved 8 times in the following decades, first around Spain and then overseas to Mexico. In the 19th century, the rising swell of pride in indigenous Mexican identity meant that Cortes became a figure of hatred, and the marker on his tomb was hidden for fear it would be destroyed. Finally, his bones were moved to Jesus Nazareno Church in Mexico City, next to the Pino Suarez subway station. His burial place is marked only by an orange plaque bearing his name and dates, and today he receives few visitors. We could hardly put it better than a Mexica poet, whose words come down to us persistently, defiantly, through the centuries. Friends, let us still rejoice. O friends, be not sad. It is true the earth is nobody's possession. None shall remain upon it. Only a brief moment we wander intoxicated beside thee, at thy side, O giver of life. It is only a place where we know one another on earth. None shall remain upon it. Feathers of Quetzal are torn, paintings they are destroyed, flowers they wither, everything goes to his home.